The bailed out banks paid big bonuses.
Today, the Pazar calls those payments unjustified.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, July 23rd. Ken Feinberg is the president's special master for executive compensation. Today, he calls out some banks for excessive bonuses.
Europe releases tests of their big banks' stress. How the e-reader can mess up your meter? And we'll make time for another quick rhyme. But first,
the government's Pazar is out this morning with a report on eye-popping money paid by financial companies that got taxpayer bailouts. Today's report from Kenneth Feinberg spotlights pay at Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, GM, Chrysler, and others. Here's John Dimsdale from Washington.
Feinberg says even after the bailout, questionable salaries and bonuses at those companies totaled over $1.5 billion. But other than talking about the excessive payouts, there's not much Feinberg can do. The salaries aren't illegal, and 11 of the 17 have already paid back their taxpayer liability. The financial regulatory reform law signed this week does little to address compensation levels. It calls for stockholders to give advice on pay. Jane DeRista at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst says that's good, but
it is by no means sufficient because it's voluntary. And there, unfortunately, we have simply, missed a major opportunity to change the culture.
This is Feinberg's last report as Pazar before taking over as administrator of the $20 billion fund to compensate people and businesses hurt by BP's oil spill. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, July 23rd. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects the United States. Today, regulators in London will give a grade to more than 90 European banks. The so-called stress tests are meant to restore confidence in Europe's financial system. However, early reports show several Spanish banks have failed the tests. Last year, the U.S. stress-tested 19 banks, and 10 of them came up short. The BBC's Rebecca Singer reports the American tests are generally considered a success.
There was a lot of uncertainty when 10 US banks were told they needed to raise $75 billion immediately. But Jim O'Neill, the chief economist at Goldman Sachs, says it actually helped clear the air and gave the banks some credibility.
The whole recovery of global financial markets coincided with the timing of the stress tests. And so, particularly with the benefit of hindsight, it's now seen rather easily that that was one of the key things to helping bring around the recovery.
Like the US tests, European banks are being examined to see if they'd survive another downturn. But in Europe, there's some concern that the worst-case scenario being considered isn't bad enough.
I think it would be implausible for them to come out and say all 91 are just tickety-boo.
Sir Howard Davis is director of the London School of Economics. He says the banks that fail need to have a backup.
That was what was successful in the US. The markets were actually able to provide new capital for banks.
Test results will be posted with 2 hours left of US trading, so it could be an exciting end to the week on Wall Street. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
What could those grades mean to Americans? We turn to Chief Economist Chris Lowe at FTN Financial. He joins us every Friday from New York. Hello, Chris.
Good morning, Bill.
So I notice Europe's releasing these tests after their markets close up for the weekend, but they're going to hit Wall Street in the middle of the day. How much mystery is there about the results?
Well, I tell you what, this is pretty much, it's a big deal for us. We've been watching this since midnight last night, watching the Asian news to see as the first rumors of results came out. I think you're going to see the market moving all day as the results of these tests come into the news.
And Chris, how much does the stress of Europe's banks affect Americans?
Well, that's a great question. There's two reasons this matters. One of them is that, of course, the global economy is interconnected. And if Europe's banks turn out to be in bad shape, the European economy will suffer, and the global economy will suffer. But I think what's even more important than that is the interconnectedness of global finance. If the European banks have to raise capital, it means they can make fewer loans, and that means the cost of loans goes up, not just for them, but for everyone globally.
Mm-hmm.
More expensive to borrow means fewer loans and a little slower economy. So that's why it matters, and that's why the U.S. stock market is reacting.
Economist Chris Lowe at FTN Financial, thank you.
You're welcome.
Today is reporter Scott Tong's last day in Shanghai. Scott has spent three and a half years covering China for Marketplace, crafting stories in a place that has seen dramatic economic change. We thought we'd bring him in to share some notes with us as he's headed out. Good morning, Scott.
Hi, Steve.
Scott, take us back to when you first arrived in Shanghai, just to give us sort of a clue as to how things are different there.
So we got here January 1, 2007, and I bought a map, and it's now obsolete. It tells you how much this place has changed. We have four new subway lines, three giant new shopping malls, and property prices per square meter in Shanghai have doubled. And the stock market has gone from 2,000 all the way up to 6,400 and back down to 2,000.
Which stories, Scott, over the years have fascinated you?
Well, last year, Steve, I was up in northern China in Shanxi province. And I met a coal miner there. Now, coal mining is one of the most dangerous jobs in China. 20 coal miners die on average every day here in China. Mm-hmm. And here's what was interesting. He said, you know, I wish my child could have one of those jobs that I used to have, to go all the way down in the bottom of the mine to make $1.50 an hour, because despite all the risks, it is really good money. So I think when we think about China and working conditions, what I found almost everywhere is people want these jobs.
Any last stops before you get out of there, Scott?
Well, if I have a little bit of time, I want to go to a place called the Park Hotel, which I never went to. My mom was born in Shanghai, and when she was a little girl, she used to go to the Park Hotel and have tea. That is supposed to be the central point of Shanghai, and then you see where it's grown. But, you know, a little bit of old Shanghai still remains, including the old Park Hotel. I'm going to go give it a shot.
That's great. Well, safe travels to you, Scott. Thank you for your service in Shanghai and in China and all your coverage there. And we wish you the best of luck as you come back home.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, July 23rd. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. The Department of Education is proposing some controversial new rules for for-profit colleges, places such as the University of Phoenix and DeVry. The industry's been under attack for heavy student debt loads. From the Marketplace Education Desk, Amy Scott reports.
Appropriately, the proposed rules are a two-part test. Education officials will look at the debt graduates take on relative to how much they earn, as well as the loan repayment rates of former students. Schools that don't meet certain thresholds would face restrictions on enrollment or become ineligible for federal student aid. The industry says the proposed rules would hurt student access to education. Career colleges say they help people who aren't served by traditional colleges. Donald Heller directs the Center for the Study of Higher Education at Penn State. He says limiting access may be appropriate in some cases.
If it's going to mean that students aren't going to be able to enroll in programs that are dead-end and don't lead them to gainful employment, then I'm not sure that that's necessarily a bad thing, that they no longer have that as an option.
Education officials estimate under the new rules 5% of for-profit and vocational programs would no longer qualify for federal aid. More than half would have to warn prospective students about potential debt loads. The public now has a month and a half to comment on the proposal. The Obama administration hopes to finalize the rules by November 1st. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Walmart says it's going to roll out electronic tags in an effort to keep track of some of its merchandise, mainly jeans and undergarments to start with. The Wall Street Journal reports beginning in August, the behemoth retailer will place removable radio frequency ID tags on individual garments that can be read by a handheld scanner. The tags will help Walmart workers quickly learn which garments are missing from store shelves. Miguel Bustillo is a staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. He's with us live from Houston. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Hey, why is this such a big deal?
Well, Walmart is the world's largest retailer, and there's a history of Walmart practices being adopted by the entire industry. So Walmart taking this step could lead for this technology to be adopted widely by retailers.
Yeah, by big retailers, you know, maybe Target and others, right?
Correct.
Yeah. How much is this going to cost Walmart, and is it going to cost anybody else?
Well, it's a very good question. Walmart is not specifying what this is going to cost, but needless to say, this is probably going to cost tens of millions of dollars. And what's interesting that Walmart did confirm is that Walmart is going to be subsidizing the cost of these tags, at least initially, for its suppliers, which kind of suggests that perhaps they had to be, nudged into participating in this experiment.
You think that's something that's going to keep going on as we move forward? The suppliers are going to have to pay a lot of this cost?
Well, the suppliers still have to pay some of the costs of actually adding these tags into their manufacturing process and whatnot. So it's not like they're not having to pay anything. But I think eventually Walmart expects that the price of these tags will go down remarkably as they become common. And that, I think that they're eventually going to have to foot the bill.
Hey, quickly, Miguel, why are privacy advocates concerned about these tags?
Well, the main concern that privacy advocates have is that these tags could be used to essentially track people's movements. When you leave the store, these tags don't get turned off, and therefore they're worried that somehow the information could be used by unscrupulous people to essentially track people's movements. And even though it's going to be on the packaging, Walmart did that on purpose to try to minimize those concerns. Some privacy advocates are concerned that the people will scan your trash to see what you bought and learn about your personal purchasing behavior.
To see what's inside and steal from you, perhaps.
Yeah, although yeah. I think we should point out that presumably there's easier ways to find out if you just bought a big screen TV, like looking through your window or seeing the big cardboard box
That's
in your
right.
driveway.
Something else to worry about. Miguel Bustillo, a reporter from The Wall Street Journal. Thanks.
Thank you.
It may still be far behind Facebook, but Twitter has been growing a lot lately. The social networking site now has 125 million users, with 300,000 people signing up every day. That's causing the Twitter system to freeze. Not so good for a site that's about instant communication. But there are some fixes in the works, as April Dembosky reports.
Some Twitter users have become all too familiar with the fail whale. That's the pleasant cartoon image that translates to, your tweet is going nowhere. San Francisco business consultant Elizabeth Potts Weinstein gets it at the worst times, like when she's launching a new product.
Wish they would let us pay for something so we could have more reliable services. I understand it's free, so we can only expect so much, but we would pay for it. But they won't let us. So.
Right now, another company stores and manages Twitter servers. But Twitter will open its own data center near Salt Lake City this fall.
It's a little bit like building your own house versus moving into an apartment.
That's Twitter spokesman Matt Graves. He says the custom data center will give the company more capacity and more control.
This is the first of several data centers that we're going to be opening.
Twitter is the latest Bay Area company to build a data center in Utah. eBay and Oracle are both investing millions of dollars in the state. In San Francisco, I'm April Dembosky for Marketplace.
We got a less than stellar jobless claims report yesterday. Couple that with a jobless rate of 9.5%, and we get an idea of how much recovery the job market's going to need. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich is with us now to talk about what he thinks we can expect going forward. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Steve.
Why is unemployment staying so high?
Well, the short answer is there's just not enough demand in the system. And employers aren't going to start hiring until they know consumers are going to start really buying again.
And where does the unemployment rate need to be, Bob? I mean, what should the goal be?
Well, roughly about 5%. We got down to 4% in the 1990s, but most economists would be satisfied if we were back at 5% unemployment.
How long before we get there?
Well, that's the question. I think at least 3 or 4 years at the rate we're going, Steve, which is bad enough. But there is a possibility we won't see 5% unemployment again for a decade. In fact, some people are now predicting joblessness is going to stay high.
And why is that?
Because so many employers have used the recession to do what they've wanted to do for a long time, and that's pare back payrolls, using the internet to outsource abroad, and new software applications to do many of the things that people used to do. These jobs are never going to come back. And if this becomes the new normal, we could be seeing a permanent reduction in demand for workers.
So that's what we have to deal with, is permanently high unemployment.
Well, I'm not that pessimistic, but I do worry that in order to get new jobs or keep the old jobs, millions of Americans are going to have to accept lower wages. And the long-term problem will not be jobs. It will be incomes.
Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich and current professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Bob, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Bill Radke. The e-retailer Amazon has reached an exclusive deal to bring books by Nabokov, Cheever, Updike, and Roth to the Kindle. It's the first time these works have appeared on electronic devices. E-readers may or may not be okay for novels, but they're not so well-suited to poetry, as former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins found out when he downloaded his latest poetry collection called Ballistics. Billy, welcome to Marketplace.
Thank you.
How did you find the meaning of your poetry changed on the screen?
Well, it wasn't so much the meaning. It was just that poetry comes in lines, like gasoline comes in gallons. And if you wanted the name of the creature that is the poet, they are like homo linearium. They're like line-making creatures.
Yes.
And that's what we do. We make lines. Charles Olson, the poet, said, "No line must sleep. Every line in a poem should be wakeful to the lines around it." And when you put a poem on a Kindle, the lines are broken in order to fit on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of it being the poet's decision, it becomes the device's decision.
The line not only sleeps, it falls halfway out of the bed.
It falls, very good. It sleeps with its foot, one foot out of the bed.
What are digital media companies doing about this?
I don't know if they're aware of the problem or whether they would even consider it a problem. You know, to a poet, it's quite ruinous to have a poem distorted out of shape or squeezed, shall we say, into this tiny screen. But I'm not sure big digital companies are sensitive to the needs of poets. I mean, I know the rest of the population of America isn't, so why should they be?
You are former poet laureate Billy Collins. I mean, are you going to try and throw your poetic weight around with these companies?
I'm not sure there's that much weight involved. It's called bantam weight, I think.
Mm.
I mean, I'm all for poetry catching up with technology. And just as there are iTunes, I think we should have iPoems. I mean, people should be able to walk around with their earbuds in and listening to poems on their iPod. And poems are perfect for something to listen to while you're walking around because they don't take very long.
I think you just hatched a great idea on Marketplace, iPoems. The new digital attention span could be a boon to poetry.
I think poetry has been waiting for people to be afflicted with short attention.
Former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Very nice to talk to you, too.
And Collins was kind enough to read me a poem. You can hear it at marketplace.org. From poetry to doggerel now, the week's business news in a Marketplace Minute. While the average Joe is hurting, 3M, Xerox, Halliburton, Coca-Cola, Caterpillar, all their bottom lines were killer. American Express, UPS, and their success is great, I guess, but over at the Central Banky, Ben Bernanke sounded cranky. Sales are drowsy, credit's lousy, housing pain is up again, so clearly there's this wide divide. Can these global firms provide the jobs to stop the slide and turn the tide? I can't decide. Democrats face the facts about the so-called carbon tax. There's no Republican that backs it. Since it lacks the vote, they axed it. And a study of summer vacation shows it's not a relaxation. Either we spend it working a lot or we fret about unanswered emails we've got. So if you're sitting under a coconut tree, and I hate to say this, do not go to marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Updates.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.